listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a long-standing journalist of food, health, and the environment, covering advocacy, science, policy, and all the things that we need to be aware of in our world to protect our health and environment and well-being. Each week on Connect the Dots, I talk with different advocates, authors, scientists, filmmakers, poets, political folks, doctors, and everyone who tends to different aspects of what comes together in our internet-connected world to create the foundations for our well-being, the well-being of children and future generations on our beloved habitat planet Earth. As many listeners know, I have a long background in both health reporting, food reporting, and environmental coverage, beginning most notably in the 2008-2009 fracking wars in the Northeast region, the goal of preventing our water supplies, farms, foods, air, rural and urban environments from being polluted by the industrial activity of fracking. Today we're going to be returning to that discussion and that theme, which has served as a wake-up call for so many people, both in our Northeast region, around the country, and around the world. The drive to become water protectors, earth protectors, has never been more needed and more front and center for us than it is now. And I am delighted to welcome back to the show today's guest, who has also been here before. And when I announce her name and title and we begin to talk about her new book and what she's bringing forward at this time, all of these connections will be much more apparent. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Maya Van Rossum, the Delaware Riverkeeper.
Thank you so much for having me again, Allison. I really enjoy being on your show and really enjoy having this opportunity again to join you and your audience to talk about these important issues.
Yeah, it's really great to have you back. And you know, I recall our prior conversation was so terrific because, you know, we're really part of the extended field of people who are stepping up to protect what's most valuable for life here on Earth. And, back when the whole move to frack the Northeast was launching almost a decade ago, we didn't go under the name water protectors. And that name has emerged through, you know, the courageous work of indigenous populations in seeking to bring people together to prevent the construction of an oil pipeline in the northwestern and middle western part of this country. But we are certainly all water protectors. I think, you know, all of the people who are standing up for the environment are protecting water first as well as everything else that we need for life. So I'm sure our listeners are intrigued by your title, Delaware Riverkeeper. Please tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do and what's entailed in that fantastic work that you're doing.
Sure. So I am the person that is honored to bear the title, the Delaware Riverkeeper, and I have an organization called the Delaware Riverkeeper Network. And our organization works throughout the four states of the Delaware River watershed, including New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware. And we work at the federal level to the extent that we need to protect our beautiful Delaware River and its watershed. While I am the person that is honored to bear the title of the Delaware Riverkeeper and to have the job description of being the voice of the Delaware River, we all know that protecting any water body is not the job of one person. It really is the job of a community. And that's why we have the Delaware Riverkeeper Network. We have tens of thousands of people throughout the Delaware River watershed that work with myself and my staff of 20 to champion the rights of our communities to a Delaware River and to tributary streams that are free-flowing, that are clean, that are healthy, and that are abundant with a diversity of life. And working together, we champion that cause. At the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, we primarily use advocacy and litigation to literally fight the good fight for our beautiful rivers, streams, and watershed. But we also have a very robust scientific program because science is key to good advocacy and good litigation. We have a restoration program where we go out and work to restore health to streams that have been damaged. And, of course, we do a lot of outreach to help communities get the information and learn the strategies they need to be able to stand up on their own and with the Delaware Riverkeeper Network to protect the natural resources in their communities.
You know, one of the things, I was actually recently doing some writing on a work that I'm developing, and I was writing a bit about the initiative to protect the Delaware River Basin from fracking, from, you know, having that industrial activity with the waste it occurs, you know, and occurs with noise and the pollution, all of that, so near to a water supply, you know, a river that is both beautiful, a part of our country in this gorgeous land. At the time that I first became involved with this, it was considered by the organization American Rivers to be the most threatened river in the United States because of the threat of fracking drilling coming to the river basin. And it also feeds the water supplies of several, you know, important northeastern communities. And yet, you know, here were representatives of an industry cavalierly wanting to go in and, you know, claiming they weren't putting it at risk. And, you know, we didn't at the time have all that much evidence about the real risks that were being incurred. And, of course, that has come over time through the work of your organization and other organizations. I mean, you know, it's just really when you think back on it, it's been a long, I mean, how many years has it been? 8 or 9 years fighting to protect this one river, a major river of the Northeast. Can you tell our listeners about how you got involved and where we are now in that?
In the fight regarding fracking and shale gas extraction in the watershed?
Yep.
Okay, because of course we have many, many issues we've been fighting for many decades, this being just one of the unfortunate most recent. Actually, the story of the fight to protect the Delaware River watershed from drilling and fracking operations began in a very key way before we even knew about drilling or fracking. The Delaware Riverkeeper Network has been around since 1988, and one of the very first things that we did back when we were getting started was we petitioned the Delaware River Basin Commission and rallied the troops, literally, to secure a special designation and regulations to protect the high quality of the upper reaches of the Delaware River watershed, the non-tidal reaches. And long story short, back in the early 90s, we did secure a special designation for the river called Special Protection Waters. And with that special designation came a special body of regulations which committed the Delaware River Basin Commission to protecting the, quote, existing water quality of the Delaware River, which was very, very high. That designation applied from essentially the water gap up. A number of years later, when wild and scenic designation was given to the lower reaches of the non-tidal Delaware River from Washington Crossing up, we once again pursued this special designation for those other reaches of the Delaware River watershed. And when all was said and done, we secured, and I think it was about 2001, we secured, maybe it was a little bit later, maybe it was 2005, we secured Special Protection Waters designation for the entire non-tidal Delaware River. That's the highest level of protection any river in the nation has under the law, or the longest stretch of river that has this highest level of protection. So we have this protection. We put this in place understanding how precious our water resources were in the watershed and how many threats our beautiful Delaware River, so fundamentally important to so many, how many threats it was facing. We then had, in the mid-2000s, drilling and fracking operations start to come into and sweep across Pennsylvania. When the drilling and fracking operations, started to come close to the Delaware River watershed, it became clear that our watershed was going to be targeted and the industry was knocking on the boundaries of our Delaware River watershed. We went to the Delaware River Basin Commission with this Special Protection Waters designation in hand, and we said, DRBC, you must put in place a moratorium on drilling and fracking operations within the boundaries of the Delaware River watershed because you cannot meet that high standard of protecting existing water quality if this dangerous industrial operation is allowed to come within the boundaries of the watershed. And as a result of all of that effort, as early as 2010, we secured one of the first moratoriums in the nation against drilling and fracking operations that were secured. And it was a prohibition on drilling and fracking within the boundaries of the watershed. But there was a limitation on that moratorium. That moratorium stays in place until such time as the Delaware River Basin Commission passes regulations that allows drilling and fracking in a way that will protect existing water quality. Now, we at the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, of course, know that the DRBC can never meet that standard because you cannot drill and frack and protect water resources. And so if they were to ever put in place those regulations, we are already poised to go to court and challenge them as being a violation of the Special Protection Waters Program. Nonetheless, we have actually right now a proposal advancing that could lift to some degree, large or small, we don't know yet, that moratorium on all aspects of drilling and fracking operations within our watershed. So while we have enjoyed protections for the last 7 years, and during that time, the Delaware Riverkeeper Network has worked with communities beyond the watershed boundaries to try to defeat drilling and fracking operations, because drilling and fracking anywhere hurts all of us. So we're not just about stopping it in the watershed. We're about stopping it everywhere. But we've been spending those 7 years building the case for continuing protection of our watershed and advocating to get that moratorium turned into a permanent ban. We've been fighting with other communities to try to make the case that drilling and fracking should not be allowed anywhere, including being a part of the effort to secure the ban in the state of New York. But right now, we have a focused effort because our Delaware River watershed is once again being very specifically targeted with the potential for having that moratorium lifted and those industrial operations entering our watershed, we don't know yet to what degree. November 30th is the day we're supposed to know what the Delaware River Basin Commission is proposing for our watershed on the fracking front.
Wow. Can you just tell our listeners what cities get some or all of their water supply, or, you know, what large metro areas get some or all of their water supply from the Delaware River?
Well, one of the biggest is New York City. Chances are, if you're in New York City, you're drinking Delaware River watershed water, even though the city is in the Hudson River watershed. And that river is so well protected and is so clean that it does not go through a water treatment plant before it gets to city faucets. The New York State and New York City have done an incredible job protecting the upper reaches of the watershed in order to protect the purity of the drinking water that folks in New York City get to enjoy. But we also have other cities, you know, as you go downstream, and communities large and small that pull their water from the Delaware River, including Yardley, including Trenton, including the city of Philadelphia. and communities elsewhere in New Jersey. So there are a lot of people. There are over 20 million people, in fact, who get, or sorry, over 17 million people who get their drinking water from the Delaware River.
So that what that goes to is that, you know, anyone listening to this program who falls into any of those regions, you might want to follow the organization Delaware Riverkeeper online because not too far away, just a few weeks away from now, the fate of your own drinking water could be a risk. And this is, you know, there are ways to participate and have a voice and a say and join those who are protecting the water and our access to clean drinking water from fracking and other noxious substances. And this is a way to get involved. You know, usually, I mean, the thing that always amazes me is that an organization like yours is there at the front lines fighting this. And, of course, you have a big network of people, and many people are aware of it and supporting it and taking a stand together, which is one of the great virtues of activism that I'm always touting on this program. But, you know, a lot of other people may be there, and this may, you know, help determine the fate of their water, the fate of their health. You know, water is an important I can say this as a health journalist. It's the purity of our water. It helps flush our systems. It runs our body. We're made up of water, and so the healthfulness and purity of our water is super important. And you know, as one who's reported on various forms of health imbalance and downturn and problems, you can have some kind of change in what your the resources that you're depending on, and it can really have a health impact that you may not know has happened, that you may not recognize as it occurs. So I would really strongly urge people, if you're in New York or Philadelphia or any of these intervening locales in New Jersey, to get involved. Now, let's talk a little bit further, because one of the ingenious things that you describe in this long initiative to protect quality drinking water for 17 million people is the fact that you had wisely come up with this high-quality level of protection, which kind of acted like a sort of repellent raincoat. you know, you don't go there because, you know, the Delaware River is guaranteed to have high-quality water, and this activity would obviously run counter to that. And so I think what this points to is the kind of opportunity that you're describing and offering in your new book, The Green Amendment, which is, you know, finding legal remedies, not only reactively, as in, you know, please don't come now that I know you're in my backyard and, you know, you're about to ruin my entire community or poison my water, and now suddenly I'm organizing my neighbors, and of course, that has to be done, too, when that's what's going on. But what you're talking about in your new book, The Green Amendment, is really putting in place legal protections ahead of the curve, proactively, you know, rather than reactively, community by community, responding defensively when these various environmentally damaging initiatives come, you know, tap dancing down the pike right towards us and into our environs, rather than kind of recognizing that, to quote the subtitle of your book, securing our right to a healthy environment is a right of all that we have to support and put in legal frameworks to sustain. So could you talk a little bit about what the Green Amendment is and how you came to evolve this?
Yeah, so, you know, people, when they think about their right to drink clean water and breathe clean air and eat healthy foods grown in healthy soils free of dangerous toxins, they, in their hearts, in their souls, and in their minds, believe that they have the right to those things. They have the right to clean water, clean air, and a healthy environment. And morally, we do. By virtue of the fact that we are people here on this earth, we should have that right. But the fact of the matter is, under the law, the laws passed across the United States of America, whether you're talking about local laws, state laws, or federal laws, we don't have actually a right to a healthy environment. Our laws don't protect our rights to pure water, clean air, and a healthy environment. Our laws are actually written to allow pollution, to allow environmental degradation to happen. And that degradation and that pollution happens with the permission of the government through permitting processes and ordinances and other approvals that government officials give in a variety of ways to industrial operations, to developers, and others who want to engage in activity that will very directly and often very seriously degrade our environment and, as a result, take from people their right to pure water, clean air, and a healthy environment. You know, if you think about it, throughout our lives from when we were children, you know, we have all been told, we have all been taught that we have the right to free speech, freedom of religion, that we have private property rights and due process rights and the right to expect a free press in the United States of America. But growing up, did you learn that you have the right to pure water, clean air, and a healthy environment? You didn't, because those other rights that I talked about are protected in the Bill of Rights sections, in the Declaration of Rights section of our state and federal constitutions. But the right to a healthy environment, for the most part in the United States of America, is not protected at that highest level in the Constitution. And as a result, protection of the environment has been relegated to local, state, and federal governments, and those local, state, and federal governments have written laws that may curb pollution, but they don't prevent pollution, and they certainly don't guarantee you that if when you go to get a glass of water out of your faucet or take in a breath of fresh air, that it is not going to be free of dangerous toxins and contaminants. But I preface that with, for the most part, because there are actually two states in the nation that at this point do promise a constitutional right to a healthy environment, and those two states are Pennsylvania and Montana. Now, you might be asking the question, Pennsylvania? Isn't that where all that fracking is taking place? Well, yes, but one of the reasons why that's happening is that Pennsylvania's constitutional right to a healthy environment, written in the Bill of Rights section of Pennsylvania's Constitution, was passed in the 1970s, but very quickly was determined by the courts to be just a statement of public policy, that it didn't really have the force and effect of law, that it was pretty language, but that didn't really affect decision-making at the governmental level. And that was what the situation was for decades in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And so when drilling and fracking came to Pennsylvania and people would try to quote their constitutional right to pure water, clean air, and a healthy environment as promised by Pennsylvania's Constitution, they were told time and time again, well, you don't really have, that's not really a right, that's wonderful language, but it's legally, it doesn't really have substantive legal meaning. Then in 2012, the Pennsylvania legislature passed a piece of legislation that ultimately came to be called Act 13. And Act 13, as easy as it was for drilling and fracking operations to overwhelm Pennsylvania communities, Act 13 was going to make it even easier for this devastating industry to take over communities across the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And we at the Delaware Riverkeeper Network at that moment said, enough is enough, and now is the moment to once again test the viability of the Environmental Rights Amendment in Pennsylvania's Constitution to truly guarantee people the right to a healthy environment. And the Delaware Riverkeeper Network joined
forces. Let me just ask a question here, which is,
sure,
could you describe for our listeners the provisions of Act 13? Because I think they're rather shocking. And when people hear about them, they have trouble believing that this is actually something that was proposed and pushed so far down the line in the United States. Can you tell us what those provisions are?
Sure. So there are lots of horrific provisions, but I'll just give you two examples that I think really demonstrate how bad Act 13 was. Act 13 mandated that drilling and fracking operations be allowed to happen in every part of every community in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania where the industry wanted to drill. It took from local municipalities the ability to use their zoning authority, for example, to say, well, we will, if fracking comes into our community, we're going to limit it to the industrial zones where other industrial operators carry on their activities. Act 13 said you can't do that. Act 13 said every community has to allow drilling and fracking operations in every part of every community, in their environmental protection zones, in their historic protection districts, in their agricultural areas, in their residential communities. They explicitly said that drilling and fracking well pads had to be allowed by state law as close as 300 feet from people's homes. So while you bought your home in a residential area, you now could find 300 feet from your property line a drilling and fracking well pad. Act 13 put in place a medical gag rule, which said that if you were sick and you went to your doctor and your doctor believed that your illness might be related to drilling and fracking operations, and your doctor wanted to go to the fracking company and find out what chemicals, what toxins have been used by the company that could be creating your very serious health problems. The only way the doctor could get that information from the industrial operator or force that information from the industrial operator was if they signed an agreement not to disclose to anybody, including their own patient, including other medical professionals that they might want to confer with about your condition. They had to promise that they would not share the information about the chemicals that you had been exposed to with anyone. It was called a medical gag rule. So very shocking, right? You go to your doctor, you're sick. Your doctor needs to know what chemicals have been used in proximity to you and your home and your life so that they could help identify what you were suffering from. And they could were only entitled to that information if they signed this this non-disclosure agreement. And again, couldn't tell you as the patient, couldn't confer with other doctors to help get some assistance in trying to figure out, you know, why you had this cancer or why you had this illness, why you were having nosebleeds or headaches or loss of memory and suffering the way you were suffering. That's how bad Act 13 was.
That is so totally backwards, because usually the patient, you know, all of the HIPAA papers that we always sign going to a doctor are basically the right of the patient to control the privacy and release of any information that's pertinent, not the right of others to withhold relevant information from the person who's sick.
Yeah.
That is just unique. Where did that actually come from? I mean, who dreamed this up?
So what we came to learn after the fact was that Act 13 was very literally written by representatives for the industry and handed to Pennsylvania legislators to adopt whole cloth and pass, which is what they did. And there were champions like Representative Joe Scarnati who just thought this was beautiful language that should advance and that it was perfectly fine. And he championed all the elements of Act 13. In fact, right now, he is leading the charge as a Pennsylvania legislator to try to get the moratorium on drilling and fracking in the Delaware River watershed lifted, trying to use his role as a Pennsylvania legislator to do what he can do to get that critical protection taken away from Delaware River watershed communities. So he was a champion for Act 13, and you know, but of course it took more than just Representative Scarnati to pass it. There were many legislators that voted for Act 13 in 2012, and it passed very quickly, and it was devastating. It was devastating. So that's why we joined forces with seven towns that to challenge Act 13, and we had a wonderful team of what I call a dream team of lawyers, three very smart gentlemen, Jordan Yeager, Jonathan Smith, and John Kamen. John Smith and Jonathan Kamen. I always mix them up. And they pulled together a collective of really important legal arguments, of course, informed by their clients. The argument that the Delaware Riverkeeper Network and I, as the Delaware Riverkeeper, advanced through our legal counsel, Jordan Yeager, was the idea that Act 13 was so egregious that it violated the constitutional amendment, what's known as Article 1, Section 27 of Pennsylvania's Constitution, that promises the people of Pennsylvania the right to pure water, clean air, and a healthy environment. There's more language to the provision, but long and short, that's essentially what it says. And it commits every government official in the Commonwealth to protect that right, and they have to protect that right not just for the generations who are here today, but for the generations yet to come. And by the time the case got up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, you know, there were a number of layers of activity. But long story short, in December 18th of 2013, we got a very powerful decision written by a conservative chief justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, with the Supreme Court itself being a very conservative Supreme Court when you looked across the board of the justices. And this Chief Justice Castile, wrote the plurality opinion, the opinion that represented four of the justices on the court, and used as a primary basis for their determination that critical elements of Act 13 that we were challenging, used as their basis that Act 13 violated Article 1, Section 27, and people's environmental rights in the Commonwealth. And suddenly, life, legal life, was breathed in to that Environmental Rights Amendment. Now, it was only a plurality opinion. The fifth justice joined those four justices in declaring elements of Act 13 unconstitutional, but found other reasons for that declaration. So those critical elements were deemed unconstitutional. But notably, in rendering that concurrence, that justice did not refute in any way what Chief Justice Castile and the other justices were saying about Article 1, Section 27. He simply relied on other legal arguments for his determination that these elements of Act 13 were unconstitutional. So in 2013, at the end of 2013, we suddenly had a constitutional right to a healthy environment in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. After that decision, I really, you know, saw what incredible power could come from this kind of constitutional protection and recognition of our environmental rights. And I looked across the nation to see what the situation was. And what I found was there was only one other state, Montana, that had a provision written and implemented by the courts that was on par with what we had in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. All the other states either had nothing about environmental rights or they had something far lesser than what you have in Pennsylvania. They did not have provisions in the Bill of Rights section. They had provisions that protected fishing and hunting, but not the right to pure water, clean air, you know, and healthy environments. That to the extent that they talked about environmental rights, they empowered the legislators to define and protect those rights. So if the legislators passed a bad piece of legislation that was not very protective of the environment, well, the constitutional obligation was fulfilled, and the people did not have the right to challenge it. And so that's what inspired me to write the Green Amendment, is I really to try to tell the story of Pennsylvania, to talk about the history of environmental regulation and degradation in the United States of America, and try to inspire communities across the nation to rise up and pass environmental rights amendments on par with what we have in Pennsylvania and Montana to really secure their right to a healthy environment. And as we go across the nation getting this conversation and this act, these actions going to secure constitutional protection and recognition of our environmental rights, we will get people to recognize and see that not only do we want to protect these rights in state constitutions, but we need a federal environmental rights amendment so that when our federal legislators overstep and support and allow decisions and pass legislation or roll back regulations in a way that allows actions, activities, and decisions that cross over the line and take from people their right to a healthy environment, that we, the people, now have a tool that will allow us to go straight into court and challenge that devastating action, activity, or decision.
Wow. So this is absolutely, I mean, you began with this, as you're describing, back in 2012 and 2013, and that's 4 years ago. And, you know, and you had this unique experience of finding a protection that was little regarded, but still on the books, that served, you know, as an important roadblock to this terrible and destructive overreach of Act 13. Little did you know, or perhaps you saw it coming, that, you know, 4 years from now we would be in a national political context where, you know, all of the EPA regulations are being stripped down, the whole agency is being stripped down, its content is being buried, its people are being let go or silenced. You know, very, very adverse regulatory environment that has descended upon us just within the last year, you know. And so what you're positing is that a green amendment at both state and then building to a national level serve as a different order of protection that the people can get behind and try to push through as a countermeasure. And in that way, when these, you know, there's a legal basis for challenging these terrible, you know, this whole devolution of environmental protection at the worst possible time that this could be happening, namely when we are mounting toward a crisis that was preventable when it was originally diagnosed, but with every with the long-standing and, you know, multi-decade failure to deal with it is getting worse and worse and worse. And at these latter phases, as we're, you know, already experiencing tremendous examples of, you know, tragedies of environmental degradation, you know, this, we're losing the very protections that were, you know, farsightedly created. So you're saying that the Green Amendment can actually serve as a bulwark in these times.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, I didn't have to foreshadow the current state of affairs to see how powerful and important having a Green Amendment movement that sweeps across the nation is, because we already knew, we could already see that the laws that we had in place at the local, state, and federal level were not doing the job of protecting mm-hmm. people's right to pure water, clean air, and a healthy environment. Witness Flint, Michigan. Witness the devastating floods and storms and wildfires and droughts that are taking place that to a very significant degree are related to human actions and human activities. Certainly climate change very directly related to human activities. Many of the floods and flood damages that communities are experiencing are the result of inappropriate development and development strategies and deforestation. You know, we have communities across the nation that cannot trust that the water that they are drinking is clean and healthy and safe. We have children taking in, you know, breathing in air that is causing asthma attacks and causing illness. People are taking toxins into their body through all sorts of pathways that are causing cancer to fester, to take hold and fester in their bodies and overwhelm their lives, even take their lives. And these are cancers related to the exposure to these dangerous toxins. And all of this is happening despite the fact that we have environmental protection laws in place. So when our laws, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and other laws were passed, you know, they did do an important job of reducing pollution in very meaningful ways, so that, you know, after the first 20 years of the Clean Air Act being in place, we saved many lives from heart disease and bronchitis, and we prevented childhood respiratory problems by reducing the pollution in the air. But we still allow pollution to go into the air. Fracking operations is a perfect example. There are tremendous volumes of pollution that go into the air legally, despite our environmental protection laws and toxins that go into the water and onto the land and the cutting of forests that are critically important for the quality of our lives, the safety of our lives, for species that are important, have important enriching elements to our lives. So despite the fact that we have all these laws in place, we still continue to experience growing degradation of our environment and certainly not protection of our rights to pure water, clean air, and a healthy environment. Passage of green amendments take on that role, allow people a pathway to defend their right to a healthy environment against the gaping holes in our laws that are allowing degradation to continue. Yes, I mean, I will be perfectly honest. The day after the election last year, I immediately recognized the powerful importance of the book that I was writing, because Donald Trump and the Republicans had already announced as part of their platform that they were going to roll back critical environmental protections and advance devastating industries like many aspects of the fossil fuel industry. But we didn't need to have that event. We didn't need to have all of the rollbacks that we're experiencing now to need to have these constitutional provisions across the nation. And I do want to say, in Pennsylvania, right, we didn't stop with our victory over Act 13. We are continuing, we, the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, and now other organizations are continuing to build upon our legal victory of 2013 and increasingly strengthen what it means to have an environmental right. And so we're starting to change the way decisions are being made in Pennsylvania. We didn't overnight stop fracking, but we are certainly using the Environmental Rights Amendment to, amongst other things, work towards that goal, right, to stop all kinds of environmentally devastating decisions, including the industrial operations associated with fracking. And it will take time, unfortunately, to define what it means to have an environmental right in Pennsylvania. It's only been a few years. But that's the case with every constitutional provision. I mean, think about it. The rights to free speech and freedom of religion have been enshrined in our constitutions for hundreds of years, and yet we still have litigation seeking to define whether or not a legislative decision or action or activity has crossed over the line to violating somebody's constitutional rights in those arenas. It's going to take time, likewise, in the environmental arena to define what it means to have an environmental right. But this victory we had in 2013 and breathing life into the Environmental Rights Amendment of Pennsylvania's Constitution is having a very meaningful impact in how decisions are being made and whether or not decisions by government officials in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania are being allowed to stand because they do cross over that line of infringing on people's environmental rights. So we're you know, really having great importance and strength. There was just another decision that came down a few months ago that further strengthened the definition of what it means to have an environmental right in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And we're going to keep building on those successes to protect our communities.
Let me ask you a question. Are there other states that are, you know, making moves toward adopting something like this? And what's involved?
So one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book is really to encourage other states to do just this, right? And so that is, you know, and since our victory in 2013, we have had other states already looking to what's happening in Pennsylvania and sort of pondering this concept. But we haven't had this massive sweeping movement like I want and like we need. But talking about New York State, we, the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, has been working with environmental advocates of New York and others to seek to have a constitutional right enshrined in New York's constitution. Now, in New York is one of those states that does have a provision providing some important protections on the environmental front, particularly when it comes to public lands. But it doesn't enshrine this right to pure water, clean air, and a healthy environment. And it doesn't enshrine those rights either in the Bill of Rights section of the Constitution. But thankfully, we have two legislators. We have Assemblyman Engelbreit and Senator Carlucci, who have been working on their own and with environmental advocates of New York and the Delaware Riverkeeper Network and others to put forth provisions that, if passed by the legislature two times and then by the people of New York, would become part of New York's Constitution, would be placed in the Bill of Rights section of that Constitution. That placement is critically important from a legal perspective. Can't just be anywhere in the Constitution. We really need these rights preserved in the Bill of Rights section. And if their proposals, their legislative proposals, are passed, then, and I'm reading what the provision will read, then, quote, each person shall have a right to clean air and water and a healthful environment. And New York will now join the ranks of being one of a very select few states that has protected people's rights to a healthy environment as an absolute, inalienable, inherent, indefeasible right that we, the people in New York, have and can and should defend, both with our advocacy, but also can defend in the courtrooms if our government officials overstep in ways that infringe upon those rights.
Wow, that's really amazing.
And people in New York, you know, I'm really hopeful. So we, you know, both of our organizations, again, Delaware Riverkeeper Network and Environmental Advocates of New York, have information about this on our websites. And so this fight to get this highest level of protection in the state of New York is really going to be advancing over the coming months. And I hope that people will learn about it and get engaged and be involved, because we really need the legislators in New York to understand that the people of New York don't just want these rights, but are demanding these rights and demanding the passage of the bills that will enshrine these rights in New York's Constitution.
That would be really awesome. My God, I'd love to see that happen. So this is a slow process, but what it does is it creates standing so that you have a legal case. For example, if an agency, a regulatory agency, you know, allows an industry to overstep a protection, the legal recourse for negligence toward a regulatory rule is not as powerful as a right within the state constitution. That's what you're implying, in terms of, you know, this is setting up a different way to get recourse. Because, I mean, one thinks of the situation in Dimock, Pennsylvania, where a fracking company came in, it polluted the water of an entire neighborhood. The local people appealed to the Department of Environmental Conservation in the state, and were given promises that they later reneged on, you know, in terms of supplying them with water when their water became impotable due to contamination with fracking chemicals. You know, and then ultimately the state turned on the town and began calling the people who were following through on these pleas for environmental protection from the appropriate agency. It began characterizing them as, you know, kind of a public nuisance. Like, go away, we don't want to hear from you. I mean, there we don't see the Green Amendment kicking in. What's the difference? Just, you know, so the people, like, kind of understand what it kind of can help with and what it doesn't help with so much.
Well, in the case of Pennsylvania, with everything that's happening in Pennsylvania, it's really time and timing. right? And so, mm-hmm. you know, we only breathed life, again, in December of 2013 into the Environmental Rights Amendment. So all of the actions and activities and challenges, legal challenges that came before that, weren't relying on the Environmental Rights Amendment. Now those cases are coming forth and people are reformulating their legal challenges to embrace this new constitutional right and to bring that to the fore and to secure decisions that embrace the Environmental Rights Amendment, right, and honoring those rights. So, you know, that's the thing with Pennsylvania. It is hard to explain to people that we've just had this huge sea change in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania when it comes to the law and environmental protection. But it is hard because you do still see fracking operations taking place. And part of that is because we are bringing now the battles and the challenges. So when at the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, when there have been permits issued that allow drilling and fracking operations in close proximity to residential communities and schools where children are going to school, right? We are bringing forth these challenges to that permit decision making that is allowing that to happen. And that has to wind its way through the courts. And that just mm-hmm. takes time. So we're sort of setting those precedents and getting those decisions.
That's fantastic.
But one of the things that, you know, as you alluded to, which is so important for people to understand, if you don't have an Environmental Rights Amendment, if you don't have a constitutional provision that raises environmental rights up to fundamental inalienable rights, like I'm talking about, like happens when you put these provisions in the Bill of Rights section of a constitution, then when a legislator or legislative body passes a law that says, you know, you are allowed to undertake XYZ levels of contamination of the environment or degradation of the environment, and then a regulator like the DEC in New York or the DEP in Pennsylvania or DENREC in Delaware or whatever, all the states have their own right names. But then mm-hmm. when that state agency issues a permit or renders a decision that's in compliance with that law, that, and they can demonstrate that it's in compliance with the law, well, that's the end of the story pretty much for your legal challenge on an environmental basis to that decision. But if you have an environmental right and you can show that that state agency did not consider the cumulative impacts of that, of their decision-making, did not take into consideration the science and the local specific facts in their decision-making, and as a result, they rendered a decision that allows pollution or environmental degradation that oversteps into the realm of violating the people's rights to clean air, clean water, and a healthful environment, for example, which is would be the case in New York, then the impacted citizens, the impacted residents and community members could go straight into the courts and say, yes, they complied with the law, but they didn't comply with the Constitution. And the Constitution trumps the law, for lack of a better word. The Constitution trumps the law. It is the higher authority. So mm-hmm. even if they comply with the law, if you can show that they violated your constitutional right, or that in rendering their decision they did not take into consideration all the information necessary to ensure that your right was not violated. For example, they did not take into consideration the science, the local facts, the cumulative impacts, the ramifications for future generations that might play out as a result of their decision. Then now you have it's a whole different legal battle, because now it's a constitutional claim. It's not just about what the law says. So it's very, very powerful, and it's a dramatic change in what people in New York and other states that don't have this kind of provision, what they would be facing and are facing without it.
This is brilliant. This is really brilliant. I think that's very encouraging news. I love to really hear of, you know, a major strategic solution coming into play like this. So we're kind of nearing, the end of our showtime here. But, you know, any final words to our listeners about how they can participate and get involved? Obviously, they can get your book, that is The Green Amendment, Securing Our Right to a Healthy Environment by Maya K. Von Rossum, the Delaware Riverkeeper, with a foreword, a very lovely foreword by Mark Ruffalo, a longtime water protector and social activist champion. So how do they find the book? When is it going to be published? And how can they get involved?
So the book comes out officially November 14. It is already available for pre-order, but it's officially out November 14th. There will be early next year a teacher's guide and a student guide, so high school teachers or college professors who would like to integrate this into political teachings or legal teachings or social justice teachings, anything, you know, if they think that it would be a value to their curriculum, we will have the teacher's guide and the student guide to help make that happen. I am committed to speaking to any communities that want to embrace this idea of working for an environmental rights amendment and learning how to do it, how to go about doing it. So, you know, if they're on my website, mayavemrossum.green, or on the special website we have called forthegenerations.org, there are ways to get in touch with me, and I will happily come out and speak directly and personally about this issue, about this pathway, answer questions. And also on the forthegenerations.org website, we have a lot of resources. We have toolkits that let people know all the provisions that exist in the nation and explains why, if they're not Pennsylvania and Montana, why they're deficient and don't do the job of protecting
all right,
people's environmental
really
rights.
Great. That's terrific.
So there's a lot of tools
up
there for them.
Thank you. That's really terrific. So you'll find a lot of support materials. Is that for the letter, the number four, or the letters F-O-R?
Yeah, F-O-R-T-H-E, generations.org, no spaces, no underlines.
All right, that's great. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. Again, Maya Von Rossum, the Delaware Riverkeeper here on Connect the Dots. This is a fantastic initiative. Everyone, get The Green Amendment, her new book, coming out mid-month, November. And thank you so much for your return visit to Connect the Dots and for the great work that you're doing, Maya. Really fantastic, very inspiring, beautiful. Thank you, listeners, for being with us on this edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy.